When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly interview show where top chess players, authors, content creators, and accomplished amateurs discuss their careers and share stories and chess improvement tips. Perpetual Chess is a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network, and we'd like to give special thanks to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. For more information about the show, you can go to PerpetualChessPod.com. But without further ado, let's get to the show. Listeners, we've got a fun interview with international master, author, and trainer Dean Eppolito coming your way momentarily. But first, I needed to issue a minor correction for something that I say in the conversation with Dean. It's about 11 minutes in. I was referring to a prior episode where I interviewed rating expert Dr. Mark Glickman about how rating scales have changed and how they could be changed. And I referred to him as Mark Ginsburg, who actually is an international master in chess, but a separate person. So if you want to check out that interview in addition to this one, that's episode 249. But just wanted to correct myself on that unfortunate mistake. And the other thing is, since I'm recording this intro anyway, you guys know I'm going to remind you to make sure you're subscribed to the Perpetual Chess Link Fest. It is a free weekly email newsletter Substack where I just round up the best chess links and send them to your way with little fanfare. Speaking of little fanfare, let's get you to the interview with international master Dean Eppolito. Here we go. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are here with someone I have known for something like 30 years, which is mildly disturbing to think about, but he is quite an accomplished chess player and trainer, more importantly, an author as well. He was the six-time New Jersey State champion who has recently relocated to Charlotte, North Carolina, which, of course, is quickly becoming one of the chess capitals of the United States and of the world. He won 13 national championships as a scholastic player, countless more as a coach. He's still an active player to this day, recently competed in one of the Invitational Norm tournaments in Charlotte, followed by the U.S. Masters down there. So he and I will be discussing the current competitive landscape. He is also out with a new book with New in Chess Books called Tricks, Tactics, and Tips in the Chess Opening, Practical Lessons for Ambitious Improvers. I've been checking it out, and it is a good choice both for scholastic players and for ambitious players rated below, say, 1500. Really enjoyed checking it out. So without further ado, let's welcome international master Dean Eppolito to the show. Welcome, Dean.
Thanks a lot, Ben. And it's nice to be able to talk to someone who's also kind of from our generation and still involved with chess after all these decades.
Yeah, you're making me feel old, but as to quote the great Ben Feingold, the truth hurts. So Dean, here we are recording on December 1st, and both you and I were playing in tournaments. So I thought we could talk about the chess tournament competitive landscape generally, but I wanted to start with what hopefully isn't too touchy a subject, which is your rating graph. Yes. Yours, of course, looks better than mine. But nonetheless, you've had your ups and downs. I mean, one thing I've always admired about you is, unlike a lot of players from our generation, especially you're a dad like me, you end up competing less, but you're always playing a ton. But you've had lots of... you know, you got close to 2,600 USCF in 2014, achieving a peak at 36, and then went all the way down close to 2,400, and now you're kind of in the middle around 2,500. So with all you've been through, Dean, all the top players you've played, does your rating still, is it still something you fixate on, or would you say you've moved past that? What do you think?
I try not to focus on it. This is one of the things I tell my students all the time, is if you're focusing on the rating, sometimes you're going to be happy. Sometimes you're going to be upset. But if you focus on trying to do the things you need to do to get better, the rating's going to come. So it's always hard to not focus on it. And one of the things that I try to tell, not just like scholastic players, but also like adult players that are getting discouraged, because I've been really discouraged the last, I don't know, 15 years, you see a lot of ups and downs. And the main thing is that the rating isn't what it was 20 years ago. Like, if you have someone who's 1900 now and who's an adult and they were 2000 20 years ago and they're like upset and thinking about quitting, 1900 is not the same. It's just that there's a lot of rating deflation and the kids are able to get so much better so quickly that it's really discouraging. So for me personally, yeah, there was probably a peak in about 2010 when I was almost 2,500 FIDE. And then within a couple of years, it went down to 2,330. And it doesn't have to do with age. It has to do with one, there's real deflation. And two, when you're not doing something all the time, you're going to have problems. Like, it's not the times of Botvinnik where you could just have a regular job and then play for the world championship and win. That's like completely gone. You could be Einstein. If you're not studying all the time, you're going to get worse. And so for anybody, especially adult players, you have to be doing some kind of tactics training every day. I kind of thought that it was possible to make up for it just by trying really hard during the games. And you can make up for a lot that way, but not everything. You have to do a lot of the work beforehand. And like, it starts with kind of realizing that just try not to concentrate on the rating, because it's completely different. Everybody's good now. And you're going to be playing kids that are 1800 and might be 2,400 in 2 years. So just try to focus on improving, doing some tactics training, and putting a lot of effort in during the games and not on the ratings, because it's very easy to get discouraged if you do.
Yeah, obviously good advice. And as you saw in my tournament, I started 0-3, and the way I lost in the third game was just disgusting. I couldn't blame, you know, kids being underrated, just played terrible. So it was a dark moment for me. I'm sure you've had some dark moments. So as someone who's put in all these hours and really stuck with chess, Dean, have there been times where you've thought about just focusing on training?
Yeah, there have been, but I really wanted to make Grandmaster a long time ago, and I had the opportunity to do it. Between 2007 and 2010, I was making a lot of progress, and I was really close to doing it, and then had some business and personal things that happened at the wrong time, kind of right at the peak, and I didn't really play for about 6 months, and didn't play where I could really focus for about 6 months. And then when you start playing again, you're going to have a drop. And then when you go from being really close to that 2,500 FIDE rating and you get down to 2,450, then you start thinking, all right, now I have to catch up. And you start doing things that you wouldn't normally do because you're focused on what you had before. And it kind of reminds me of what my track coach told me in high school. He said, like, well, I was a sprinter, and he said, you know, when you're behind in the last 100 meters, or if it's a 200 meters, and your form just goes away. You're trying to catch up to somebody, and you just do really badly. So this is for everybody. When you're ahead, you're just not worried about anything, and you're just concentrating on your form, and everything goes smoothly. So I kind of thought of the same thing when I just started dropping. I was trying so hard to catch up to where I had been, and it just made things worse because you're just focused on the rating. So instead of this doing the small things that got you there. And it's very easy for anybody, I mean, especially kids, to that don't have the experience, to get kind of discouraged when you see you're really close to your goal and then you fall back and then you start doing things that you wouldn't normally do and getting worried about where you were before. And then it just makes things so much worse. So that was the problem. And then it just kept getting worse from there. And you know, it's hard to kind of get out of that spiral when you're a little bit on tilt and you just see that, all right, you're really close. And then you're thinking about what you were and how far you are. And it just, it takes a lot of effort. And eventually at some point you realize, okay, just don't worry about the rating at all. Just concentrate on the things that you need to do. And then it starts to come back slowly. But the most important thing that I tell my students, if you're close to something, you have to put in the most effort you can, because if you don't do it, then you might get another chance to do it later, but it's going to be a lot harder. So now I'm trying to do it again, get back to where I was about 12 years ago. And of course, because I kind of ruined my opportunity then, it's a lot harder, which is fine. But it just is kind of good lesson for anyone who's close to something. And I just thought, oh, I'll get it the next tournament. And if you have to take time off or something happens, then you're going to be kind of starting over.
Excellent advice. Yeah. And you had mentioned when we were chatting before we recorded that you're mainly referring to, in order to achieve the Grandmaster title, you need a 2,500 FIDE peak rating as well as three norms. And your norm situation is complicated, but to you, for your level, the rating is the biggest challenge. Is that right, Dean?
Yes. Yeah. The norms I'm not worried about, because the norms in the US, I was kind of either getting the performance norms or I would have been able to play for them in the last round or two, except there weren't enough foreign players. And in the US, they won't really switch the pairings around so that you get a foreign player in the last round if you need it. So it's not just me. It's like people that are better than me, like more talented and better than me, that would have made Grandmaster, I think, if they were in another country. But it was just the issue is always that you can play five or six people that move to the United States and have the US Federation, but just moved to the United States a couple of years ago, and they all count as US players, and you have to play players from five different federations. So you could play a ton of foreign players that just moved to the US, got the US Federation, and they count as American for the FIDE purposes. So that part I'm not worried about, because if I get close, I can go play in Europe where it's, you know, you're going to get enough foreign players. But the rating is the really hard part. There's a lot of people with three norms that are having a hard time getting anywhere close to 2,500 FIDE, because it's a difficult number to reach, and it's getting more difficult because of the rating deflation. I'd say it's probably 2,500 FIDE now is maybe the same as 2,550 FIDE 15 years ago, just because there's so many underrated younger players that are playing, and you can't, someone who's 2000 now, but 2000, 15 years ago, I'd expect to be able to beat like in a simul. And now you're not guaranteed to win against them in a tournament.
Yeah. For listeners not as familiar with these discussions, I would point them towards my interview with Mark Ginsburg, who's a rating expert. But basically, new players are constantly entering the field, and if they stick with chess, they're going to improve. And they need to take their rating points from somewhere. So unfortunately, all the people of Dean and Mai's generation, older generations, even newer generations who've moved on, they sit on the sidelines with their old ratings. And that leaves people like me and Dean to swim with these young sharks. Now, we're not making excuses, or I personally, there's tons I need to get better at. So I'm not making excuses, but that is the landscape right now.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's definitely changed a lot. And I think I noticed it maybe the first time, probably at the tournament that you were playing in last weekend, the National Congress, like maybe 8 or 9 years ago, I was playing there, and I was thinking, and I was in my mid-30s, and I was looking around during a long think that my opponent had, and I was just counting how many people in the open section I knew were older than me. And it was something like 5 or 6. And right. I said, I can't believe this. Like, I'm in my mid-30s. And 10 years before, like, the average age would be 40 in the tournament. And so you go from being one of the youngest players to one of the oldest players within a 10-year period. And this isn't like professional football where you expect to age out kind of quickly. This is chess. You expect to be able to get better and experience to count for something. And the experience in some ways isn't as important as, like, the knowledge and the energy that the the kids have and with the tools now, they're able to get better so quickly that, you know, if you're playing a kid there, it could be like when I was trying to make Grandmaster, I was running into people like Sam Shanklin and Naroditsky and Sevian and Ray Robson, who you're playing in their 22 or 2300 feet A and you can't beat them. And you're like trying to make Grandmaster and you can play really well and draw them. And you're like, oh, that just hurt my chances. And you know that they're going to be 2600 in a couple of years. But there was just like an army of them. And even the people that didn't stick with it, like the kind of like the people that are good at chess and they're kids and they're practicing a lot and they're 2100 feet A, not even like considered a master. And they're really, really tough to beat. Like one example I can kind of compare to why there's like this rating deflation is that there's a lot of kids like this that get really good really quickly because they all the tools now. And then they go to college and then they leave chess and then you never see them again. So it's kind of like the analogy that is like someone kind of like robbing a bank and then, and then like just hiding the money and never spending it. So you can never get that money back. So like all the people the points were taken from, it's not, I mean, they're doing what they should do is do the best they can, but they're so underrated and they're just beating people, taking all their points. And then the adults are getting discouraged. Like what's going on. And then when they're actually the rating that they should be, they're gone. So you can never get a chance to take any of those points back. So, and there's just like kind of an army of kids like that. And it's discouraged a lot of like the older kind of weekend warrior players who you would see at tournaments 20 years ago, 25 years ago, you'd expect to like see them every weekend. And now you never see it. And I have like a story that kind of that just parallels this at every level from my first academy that I opened more than 15 years ago. And we mostly taught kids. We had some adult classes, but every Friday night I wanted to do something fun. So we did like a league night. And every Friday night, within a few months, we were getting like 60 to 70 people. And in the beginning, it was like almost 50-50 adults and kids. And there were some adults that were like 2,000. Sometimes you'd get a master to play just kind of for fun. And you'd have like a lot of like 11 to 16, 1700 adults playing. And then you'd have like all these kids that were also lower rated or same rating. And it was great. It was exactly what I wanted a club to be like. It was like 50-50 adults. It was like a club and an academy. And over the course of a couple of years, I noticed something happening. And it was like the same time period when you could see it happening like at master level in these open tournaments. A couple of the adults, they were trying really hard and they would see their ratings not going up. And you'd see all these kids like just passing them by really quickly. And now they're playing like someone who's a couple hundred points lower and losing. And a couple months later, they see the kids higher than them. And they think like, what are they doing wrong? And I'm trying to tell them like, these kids are really good. These kids are going to be masters someday. But then there's like another group of kids that come in and they're low rated and they get beaten by them too. And eventually a couple of adults start just like kind of get discouraged and quit. So then every time there's a league night, if there are four a month, instead of playing two adults and two kids every month, then the adults that are left are playing like three kids and one adult. And then that's making it kind of more discouraging for them. And there's like that just process keeps repeating and there's just attrition over a 5-year period. Like as hard as I tried, it became like 80% kids and 20% adults. And the kids are able to get better much faster. And the adults see that and they think like something's wrong. They think, oh, I'm trying really hard. Why am I not getting better? And you are getting better, but it's just, you don't see it in the rating because the kids are getting better so much faster. So it's discouraging for them. And it doesn't reflect like other things where, you know, if you're like, I knew when I was on track, like, all right, if you run like an 11.900 meters and then you do 11.7, you know, you're getting better. But like at chess, if you're 1100 and then a year later, you're like 1100 still, you're like, well, I'm trying. Why am I not getting better? You are getting better. It's just that other people are getting better faster because there are more kids playing. So when you go to some, like at any tournament now, like let's say it's even like a quads, you see when I was a kid, there were like a couple of kids playing and a couple of teenagers and everybody else is an adult. Now it's the exact opposite. And it's like, it's very it's very discouraging. The atmosphere is different. So I wanted to try to make some like adults only tournaments to try to get more adults back into it, because even at like our level, when I go to a tournament, I know, all right, if I have a bad game and I lose a game early on, well, I'm going to be sent to the kind of like the kids realm, where you're going to be playing all 12-year-old, 13-year-old kids that are really underrated, and you feel like you have to beat them, and it's not easy. And then you're just kind of stuck the whole tournament playing them, and you know you're going to be losing points, and you look back at certain tournaments and say, I played really well and I lost 20 points. Huh. And it's just the atmosphere now, and it's what makes it really difficult, and why like a lot of adults have stopped playing. And I just want them to know that you can still get better. You can still have your rating go up too, but you can still, more importantly, you can still get better and still enjoy it. But it's just, you kind of have to realize that the ratings are not what they used to be, and they don't correlate at all.
Yeah. It's a good reflection. And one thing I would just add, of course, Dean, is we're older, we're dads. So with that, you know, we have some disadvantages in terms of time and possibly neuroplasticity compared to our younger competitors. But Dean, we do have the wisdom that rating is just a number. It does, you know, it's not the most important thing. And if we're competing, it should be because we enjoy it or we get something out of it. So I just encourage listeners to keep that in mind. And that's certainly what I was telling myself when I was 0-3. But let's bring this to a practical level, Dean. So what adjustments are you making, and what adjustments do you advise for your adult students in this new landscape?
So the first thing is, the most important thing is the psychological part, that you just realize that just try to play everybody the same, and know that if you play somebody who's a kid, they're probably going to be really underrated. And if you lose, don't worry about it. It's like you could be playing the next world champion. But in terms of like practical things that you can actually do, what I started doing before these last two tournaments that went pretty well and could have gone better, I think the main thing is to realize that there's the time controls are getting faster, the kids are getting younger, and you have to kind of adjust your playing style and also how you train. And what it means, one of the things is going to be like tactics. Doesn't matter like your experience, it's almost like a disadvantage in some ways. Like they can learn things really quickly, they can pick up a new opening quickly, and experience in some ways is like is almost like a disadvantage, because when kids are training with like the engines can suggest things that like we were taught like, oh, this is just not a good idea, and the engines will prove that you're wrong. It's like a doctor spending 10 years in medical school, and then you find out later that, oh, like 20% of the stuff that you were told, it's like, now we just know it's wrong. So you have to kind of realize that, all right, they're going to be able to do things that you're not able to do, but they are going to have a difficult time doing. So the big thing that I've been doing that's made a huge difference is like tactics training every day. Mm-hmm. So I'll tell you like exactly what I'm doing, and the adult players that I talk to that are still trying to improve and even still trying to make Grandmaster, I tell the same thing too. Like it's the time control is fast. You could outthink somebody and be +2 or +3 according to the computers, and then it's going to come down to some kind of time scramble, and they're going to calculate faster than you, and you're going to blunder, and you're going to think, oh, I had a winning position. If it was a slower time control like 25 years ago, I would have won. And that's true, but you can't really do anything about it, because it's not easy for people like us in like similar situations where we have jobs, we have family. You can't like take off and go play a one round a day tournament in Europe. So what do you do if you're here? So I do 25 minutes of tactics training a day. It's like 15 minutes of Puzzle Rush on chess.com. I'll do 3 of the 5 minute trainings, and if 3 of the 5 minute tasks, and then I'll do like 10 minutes of Woodpecker. Like this great book by Axel Smith and Tickerman, which when I do it consistently, I see a big difference. And you just you're calculating things so quickly, and I treat it like a game. 25 minutes is something you can break up into two parts. You can do it during lunch. And it made a big difference when I was playing these tournaments. And when it came down to some kind of time scramble at the end, I was calculating just as well as the opponents in most cases. And much less likely to blunder. So you have to do that because these fast time controls, it's going to come down to calculation. It doesn't matter how experienced you are and how good strategically you are. If you hang something at the end because of time pressure, you're just going to lose. So, and these kids they're really good defenders. They're not just going to go down now. They're going to defend until it comes to a time scramble. And if you're not checkmating them, you can lose in any position. So you have to be really sharp tactically. The other thing that I just started making myself do with these last two tournaments, I wanted to see how much of a difference it made. I just made myself stay at the board the entire game.
Yeah.
So like the entire game, that the time, it's not like a 6 hour game now. Even if you're playing a really long game, it might be 4 hours because the time controls are faster. And I just made myself sit there. And when my opponents were walking around, or if it was their move, I was trying to anticipate everything that they could do. So I would calculate something or evaluate something and say, okay, what else can they do? And I was trying to figure out after the tournaments, like how much of a time difference that makes. And I was thinking it probably makes about 20 minutes to half an hour on your clock that you're saving every game. So if they're walking around and you're not, and you're just sitting there thinking and trying to anticipate everything, you can be ready to make a move a lot faster. You won't be surprised by things. And occasionally it can backfire if you kind of get ready to pre-move. And I did blunder once by being ready with a move to try to keep my opponent in time pressure. But for the most part, it really pays off. And you have to like use the experience and like discipline that you have to kind of outwork your opponent at the board. So I remember when I was younger, I was like walking around too much. And so I see that even with like young grandmasters today, they're up from the board a lot. And if you stay there, you can make up for a lot just by trying to work harder. But it takes a lot of discipline, but you start to see progress really quickly if you do a little bit of tactics training beforehand. A lot of work at the board, make yourself stay there. And like, of course, you have to stay up on openings, and there's tools like Chessable, which makes such a big difference and makes it much easier to memorize things. But it's a lot more work than it was when you were a kid. You could just kind of, I remember just walking around and you know, you're not as disciplined. You go out and do something social at night, and then you try to play the next day, and it's fine. Like, now you can't do that. You have to be eating well, concentrating well at the board, and then resting during the games. Like, there's not much else you can do if you want to have good results. And if you're in like your 20s or a teenager, you can still do those things and you can still make progress pretty quickly. But at this point, we kind of have to just be smart about everything that we're doing. And it's possible to get better. And it's even possible, like I'm convinced, like at any age, as long as you do these things and you kind of just kind of stick to a process, don't get discouraged, and just realize that if you have a bad tournament, it's probably more because the people you're playing against than the fact that you did something wrong.
Excellent advice. Yeah. And I'm following most of it, I have to say. I'm proud to say, mm-hmm. at least as of the past couple months. But one thing I've noticed, Dean, because I do the same thing, like back when you and I used to see each other all the time at tournaments, I was up like having casual conversations all the time during games. And yeah. I have made that adjustment. I only get up to go to the bathroom now. But right, a couple right. things have changed. I mean, there's the cheating thing. So even if you wanted to have a casual conversation, I right. think it's more frowned upon. But also, I feel like, I don't know about you, Dean, but I feel like my competitors are also at the board a lot more than they used to be. Do you notice that as well?
Yes, they are. And everybody's trying, everybody's working harder. Like the game it's different than it was when we were growing up. Like in the 90s, I remember there was a U.S. junior that was at a neighboring town to where I lived in New Jersey. And we had just graduated high school. So we had all like the players, like all the people that everyone would know their names, like Waitskin and Chiquette, all those players were there. And it was like a social gathering. So yeah. like, every night, my friends from high school would come over, and we would all like, we would just relax and we'd watch a movie or something. And we'd go over to someone's house and play basketball. And almost all the players at the tournament would do that. Now it's completely different. Now the players, they know they're going to go back, they're going to prepare, they're going to be really serious. There's like a very, there's a really different kind of atmosphere. It's like, it's less social, it's more work intense. It rewards hard work, which is good in some way, but the downside is that it's very intense, and it's a lot of pressure. You see, like, everybody's very serious, and they're not just talking to each other. They're at the board, they're concentrating. And you know, the second the game ends, they're going back to their room, putting the game on the computer, checking with the engine, preparing for the next game. And that's it. There's like, no, oh, let's all go out to lunch and we'll just see who we're playing 5 minutes before the round. Everything is much more serious. And it's like kind of happened in everything. Like, you look at any sport and it's gotten like that. But I think it's the switch has happened a lot faster in chess than it has even in professional sports, where you see if you look at a baseball player today. I know my friend Dave Vigorito, he also said, like, you look at somebody in baseball today and you compare them to like somebody who was playing like 30 years ago. Like, the person who was playing 30 years ago looks like a child compared to the person today. They're just like bigger and stronger and more serious. And in chess, one of the questions I always get when I do like presentations at schools, and I'll talk to like a parent, the question that I get the most often is either, how can my kid, or how I heard about this kid that's this age, and how did they get this good this quickly? And the best example I can kind of say is like that having the new tools, like the computer, is almost like a bigger advantage in chess than having steroids in sports. Because you're able to get so much better so quickly. And in sports, you can train like 2 hours a day, and then after that, your body needs to rest. In chess, if you want to, you can study 10 hours a day. And a lot of the kids are doing that. And I have kind of mixed feelings on like if that's healthy or not. I think that's why a lot of kids get burnt out, and by the time they go to college, they're done. But it raises the whole game. Like, everybody has to be kind of trying their best at all times. And again, it's accelerated. Like, you know, Fischer, when he took everything seriously, like, you couldn't be just like a part-time player and be able to compete with him. But now with the tools from computers, it's accelerated so fast that I think it's a bigger advantage to have some tools like this than it is to have steroids in professional sports. It's just the kids are able to get very good really quickly. They can pick things up very quickly. Their knowledge improves it so fast. And the experience that counted for a lot 20 years ago doesn't matter as much as the rate at which they can get better. And they have like their own things that they do, like school and maybe sports, but it's compared to an adult who has to work, they're always going to have less things they have to worry about. So they're able to put more effort in, and they're able to learn things really quickly. And the speed at which they're able to get better kind of makes you, even if you're improving, you feel like you're walking, and they're just like easily just running. They're like running. You see all these people like kind of make it look easy all of a sudden when there were all these people from like this kind of maybe 15 year lost generation at chess, like in between the generation of like the really good famous players like Benjamin, Fed, and DeFermian, and Rode and Sarawat and all those guys. And then the generation of kids that got good and just started to become grandmaster and a lot, it was like maybe the mid 80s, something like that. There was like a 15 year period where there's only a handful of people that were born in the United States that made grandmaster. And one of the problems was that those people that could do it, they either got like discouraged or burnt out, or by the time they got good enough to do it, and there were people like better than me that could have done it easier than I could, that just were having trouble because you're running into all these kids like every tournament where they were just 2200, 2300, and then a couple years later they're really strong grandmasters. And every time you play a tournament, you can expect your half your games to be against them. And it's it made people like, all right, it's not worth it. And there are a few people that are still trying. And I kind of want to do it just to prove that if you, like, if for anyone, that if you pick a goal, and if you just don't quit, no matter how difficult it gets, you can do it, but you have to kind of adjust what you're doing. And also, if you kind of are given the opportunity to do something, do it when you can, because as you get older, things get more difficult and the opportunities become kind of less and less. And everybody else gets better. And it's very discouraging. And I completely get what adults at every level see when they see kids kind of making it look easy. And it's just because the tools are there. They can train. They've got things that kind of we didn't have growing up, and it just makes things look easy. And it's not because you're doing anything wrong. It's just because the game has changed a lot.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, so much wisdom there, Dean. Yeah. And I hope we're not depressing anyone, because there's still plenty of enjoyment to get from mm-hmm. competing. But as you say, it's a new world. And Dean, I want to pick up the conversation and talk specifically mm-hmm. about your GM pursuit and about mm-hmm. The actual atmosphere in Charlotte. But first, Dean, we're mm-hmm. going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. Perpetual Chess is proud to be brought to you in part by our presenting chess education sponsors, Chessable.com. Chessable, of course, uses spaced repetition to help you remember tactical patterns, opening sequences, whatever aspect of your game that you're working on, and they have a huge library of awesome courses. So whatever it is you want to work on, there's a good chance you can find something to help you on Chessable. Some of their latest includes a Lifetime Repertoires course on the London from Grandmaster Sahaj Grover and Srinath Narayanan. Now, I don't want you to play the London personally, but if you're going to do it, then this is a good learning resource. Grandmaster Alex Cholovich has a new course on Bobby Fischer's Endgames. Of course, the legend R.B. Ramesh's Improve Your Chess Calculation if you really want to challenge yourself. So there's always tons to check out from Chessable.com. They have lots of free courses to check out as well. So just be sure to go to Chessable, get a streak going, and see what they have to offer.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere, and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And we are back. And Dean, before we get back to the possibly depressing topic of how to swim upstream in this environment, let's hear about the atmosphere down in Charlotte. I was hoping to play in the U.S. Masters. My family ended up hosting Thanksgiving, so I played mm-hmm. locally instead. But it looks like so much fun. They've got the media team churning out interviews. Of course, they have mm-hmm. the North Carolina Open running concurrently. So you mentioned things aren't as social as they used to be, but what was the atmosphere like at that tournament, Dean? And of course, we'd like to hear about your chess as well.
Yes, sure. And first of all, I do want to say, I don't want it to be depressing at all, because it makes, if it's difficult, if it's more difficult to do something, it can be frustrating, but then when you do it, it feels that much better. So
that's a great point.
So it's not, it's difficult. It's more difficult to do it, but as long as you realize that and you don't quit, when you do it, you can be that much happier that you accomplished it. So you just have to know going into it that it is more difficult.
Well said.
The atmosphere in Charlotte's great. So this is one of the things I wanted to do, when I was here. One of the big advantages is that there's a huge opportunity to play. Everybody is nice and supportive. The tournament atmosphere is great. There are some social advantages, because there are a lot of people that are like adults that you can play with and you can practice with, and they're running tournaments here all the time. I love the fact that it's a big hub for chess now, and that a lot of people are coming here. There's a lot of attention on Charlotte, and there's a lot of great players that are coming here, and just a great opportunity to play pretty much whenever you want at any level.
And it's kind of like a reunion. I mean, and a lot of sort mm-hmm. of prominent chess personalities, James Canty, mm-hmm. Kostya Kavutsky, the aforementioned Naroditsky, Iman Hambleton, they assembled quite a roster down there for this tournament in particular. And of course, shout out to Christopher Yu. We shouldn't bury the lead for our right. the tournament, beating Alejandro Ramirez in the playoff. So do you get to socialize more in a tournament like this, Dean? Or as you said, because of the competitive atmosphere, is it still pretty businesslike?
Yeah, that's the big thing. Occasionally you can go out to get some lunch with somebody or talk to them for a little bit. But it is harder because the games are tough. Most of the games are really long. And besides saying hi to people, talking a little bit about how their tournament's going, there's not a huge chance during the tournament. Like after a tournament's over, there is, but I kind of, and probably for some people who are younger, it's probably a little easier, but in terms of for me, I'm trying to be extremely disciplined after the second round of the day because I'm just exhausted. And I think at least two, maybe three of the rounds, the games that I had were the longest of the tournament. So by the time I was done, most people are already gone. So it'd be great to have some, obviously to have some tournaments where there's a little bit more time, have like some one round of day tournaments where you could kind of socialize with people. But I found like even like spending the slightest bit of extra energy before a round takes a big toll. Like there was a GM Norm tournament here a couple months ago. And I went to the gym with James Canty before the round to work out. And he's one of the few guys in chess that's made me feel really weak working out with. Right. And he's
beef.
Really strong. So we were working out. And then that night, like I played a kid and it was a really long game. And after 4 hours, I was the first one to blunder. And it kind of like ruined the whole tournament. So I said, I can't even try to work out during a two round a day tournament, even if there's one round that day. Just doing that, if it comes down to a split second decision later after 4 hours, I could easily just blunder something. So it's kind of like very, very, for me especially, I know I'm older than most of the players now, so I have to be really disciplined and try to eat really well, not have anything bad during the tournament, not have any sugar, and just try to get as much sleep as possible and prepare as well as I can. And I'm sure, I think even in my early 30s, I didn't have to do that. But now, like if you want to make progress, I think you have to have every little advantage kind of working for you, and any bit of energy spent on something else is like an extra percentage chance that you might blunder something after 4 hours against somebody who's half your age or a third of your age.
Yeah. No, and I experience exactly the same thing. And I know different people have different perspectives. Like recent guest of the show, Adult Improver Vishnu Warrior, is getting up at 4 a.m. to study every day. And that's never going to be me. But right. And sometimes I lack discipline in my life, but when I do go to these tournaments, Dean, these days, I take a similar approach. I mean, I'm eating healthy. I came to the mm-hmm. same conclusion as you about exercise, which is a bit unfortunate mm-hmm. because, you know, if you're trying to be in reasonable shape, it's tough. So I go for walks, but I don't do anything else, anything more right. strenuous. But yeah, it's an interesting new landscape to try to navigate.
Yeah, it's a lot more difficult. I think the times of being able to play two games a day well, and like 12, 13 years ago, if I'd be just not getting 3 hours sleep playing, and then like going into the last round where you have a chance to make a GM norm, like and it was fine. And you could do that, but I wish I had the same discipline then that I have now. Now I realize, okay, you can't do that anymore because you need every little thing kind of working for you, and and you don't. Especially at this point, I don't know how many more opportunities I'll get. Like you have getting 100 feet 8 points back or more is it's something that would have taken like a year. Maybe 10, 15 years ago. And now, you know, it's going to take multiple years of being really disciplined every tournament. So, and you have one bad tournament and you could just kind of screw up a couple of tournaments worth of work. So it takes a huge amount of discipline. And even trying to work out a little bit, you can only do it if it's one round a day. If it's two rounds a day, it just kills your energy too much to be able to play these long games. And the other thing I mentioned is that when you know you're playing kids every day, especially as you get older, you're a target for them because they see you as like someone older. And if it's a dead drawn position, and even if you're higher rated than them, they're going to try to, they know you're going to get tired first.
Yeah,
so they're going to play until the very end. And before, like 10, 15 years ago, if you're playing someone who's like a strong grandmaster and better than you, they would offer you a draw. They know, okay, it's just a waste of energy to try it. But the kids will burn every bit of energy out of you because they know that if someone's going to blunder, it's going to be you. And they're not scared to, most of them are not scared to play anything out now. So you kind of have to be ready for a fight every game. Whereas a decade or decade and a half ago, if you were tired and you wanted to just do something simple and make a draw, you could do it against people that were like professionals and higher rated than you if you really wanted to. But now you have to be ready every game or you're going to run out of energy really quickly. And if you don't lose that game, the night game, you're going to be exhausted for, and you will blunder something.
I sure will.
So, yeah.
So let's bring it back, Dean, a little bit to mm-hmm. your GM pursuit, because obviously mm-hmm. you've given some good advice already in terms of managing energy and daily practice in terms of tactics. And I think that's great advice for anyone across the rating spectrum listening. But obviously, you're at a level where even more than that is probably required. So what else is on the agenda? As you mentioned, for when you're in Charlotte, that helps a lot because you the competitive aspect, you don't have to travel as much. But what else are you going to do from a chess training perspective, Dean?
So from a chess training, it's mostly about making sure the openings are set, doing tactics training, staying kind of as healthy as possible, and playing as many tournaments. You can't go a few months without playing a serious tournament and expect things to go well.
Mm-hmm.
So one way or another, when I was playing a lot, even if I wasn't in good form, you could still make good practical decisions. So like at any age, if you're playing, that's why there's certain players that just play all the time and were able to keep like a very, like say someone like Alexander Ivanov, who was like just playing every weekend. Like it was like in his mid 50s and still like, you could say like almost peak performance because he plays every weekend.
Right.
So I think like what people think about like your brain, neuroplasticity, like going down with age, it's like only a tiny bit true. I think that the bigger factor is that people get discouraged and they don't have enough time to practice, or they think like it's not going to make a difference. And if you're playing a lot and you're training a lot, you're going to be able to get better at it. I don't care if you're 70, you're going to be able to improve, but you have to play as much as possible. So that's one of my goals, is to play like a kind of a big tournament every month and every day. No matter how tired I am, I just make sure I do this tactics training, because I can see a lot of things that I was watching, thinking about during the games, I could kind of calculate within a few seconds compared to if I wasn't in form, it would take 30 seconds or a minute. And all that energy makes a huge difference. So it's basically tactics training, playing all the time and making sure you just don't lose because you forget some opening against a kid who's kind of memorizing everything and you don't get out of the opening. So with those things, I think there's a chance, and I'm really very disappointed myself, to be honest, that I didn't do it when it was easier, but it, like 12, 13 years ago, but that's why I'm going to try to make up for it now by working really hard away from the board, by studying and especially by doing it at the board during tournaments. But it's like it's kind of maximum effort all the time now, to try to just prove that people can do it at any point. And also to my younger students that if you have a chance to do something, and I say this to them all the time, like, don't, like what I did, I was way too safe when, like, sometimes I would just take a draw, and like sometimes in positions that I should be trying to win, I'll just do it next tournament, and the rating's going in the right direction, so it'll happen sooner or later. And you never know when there's going to be a chance when you're going to have to take a break. So if you have a chance to do something, do it. And now you're trying to kind of make up for the things I did wrong when I was younger to get to something that's harder to do, a little bit harder when you're older because of time more than anything, but also because the kind of like the rating deflation has made getting back to that rating much more difficult. But if I don't do it now, I'm going to try to do it. When I'm 80 years old, I'll try to do it.
So, yeah, I mean, yeah, I can certainly relate to what you're speaking about in terms of, like, you know, everyone, I think, or it's common, I certainly do, to have like decisions, moments in your life where you wish you did something different, and circumstances come up that remind you of those moments. But there's only this moment going forward. You know, you can't change the past. So it's always this delicate balance of right. Okay, but what do I do from now? You know,
right.
And yeah, obviously there are decisions beyond the chessboard, and right. obviously it's important to you, Dean, because you've got a 2-year-old at home. So
yes,
is this like a tough calculus for you to decide, I'm going to put away that much time to continue to pursue chess and the GM title in particular? Or to you, is it just like it's a no-brainer? You want it that badly?
It is tough. It's just finding time to study. And also I'm hoping that she wants to play chess, and it also motivates her and my three other kids to just, when you pick something that you want to do, like, it doesn't matter. Just make yourself do it.
Yeah.
And if you do that right from the beginning, it shouldn't come to the point where you're trying to chase something that's much harder years later. You'll be able to do it much more easily when it comes up the first or second time. But yeah, it is difficult, but she does see chess around all the time, and I'm hoping that kind of makes her want to play. And she does, she does know the names of the pieces and how some of the pieces move. And we watched that episode of Bluey where Bluey's dad tries to, I don't know if your kids are into Bluey, but it's like the only show that I can watch that's for kids, a cartoon that doesn't make me want to pull the rest of my hair out. It's funny for kids and adults, and they have like, that's her favorite show. And there's an episode where the dad tries to teach the kids how to play chess. So I try to keep chess around all the time so that she's really interested in doing it. And I'm hoping to get this title out of the way soon enough so that if she gets interested in playing, I can kind of help coach her more too, and not be worried about kind of doing this myself. But yeah, it is hard. There's times when, what I show my students is, at some point, I realized that I was like too focused on rating. So when I started to like come close to make, some norms, like 18 years ago, I made this notebook of like weekly tasks that I needed to do, like for chess. And it was like an hour of tactics training a week. Like, you have to review a game. There was basically, I said, how much time can you devote to chess every week? And you have to do it. No matter what, you have to do it. And if you don't do it that week, it carries over to the next week. So I have this notebook of what I thought was going to be like 2 or 3 years to make the title. And now it's like almost 18 years later. And I have like week after week of checking things off. And there are some weeks where like you have a bad tournament and you're like, oh, I can't do it anymore. And you want to throw the thing out. It's like, I just quit. And it's like, you put too much into it. You can't do it at this point. Like, it's, you just have to keep trying, and it will happen if you just concentrate on doing the work that needs to be done and not on like the actual rating, because, that's something that's, you could have good tournaments and bad tournaments. And some of the tournaments I have now where I gain a few points, like these games are great. Like, if I played this way 15 years ago, that would have been a GM norm, but you're playing people who are really good, but you're slowly making progress and getting back to the same spot where things were a dozen years ago. But there are times when it's like discouraging, and it's just like I kind of I'm very competitive. And when I put my mind to decide, just no matter what, if I don't make it now, I'm just gonna, I will keep trying. So
I love it. And what's your next tournament, Dean?
So I think the there may be something during the holiday break. There's a couple of things I'm looking at. If not, probably the North Carolina Open in middle January is probably going to be the next one. And I'm just trying to make a point to look up as many FIDE tournaments as possible, because you have to get the rating back. And I also try to make a point of not going too long without playing. So I was like, the most important thing I could say to anybody at any level is just, if you can play two tournaments a month, you're going to get better, whether or not you see results. But for me, yeah, it's going to be as many of these FIDE rated tournaments I can play in the area, and then maybe some other things, maybe later in the year, maybe some other bigger tournaments, like in some other major tournaments, like in Las Vegas.
Nice. Yeah. Well, Dean, I mean, it's inspiring, heartening to hear you talk about it. So we'll certainly be rooting for you and tracking your progress. Now, I want to talk about your book next, but we got to take one more break, and then let's dig into that. I've been due for an update from our friends at aimchess.com. Aimchess, of course, gathers games from the major chess playing sites and gives you actionable intel of what aspects of your game to work on, and it helps you work on them. I've been working on some new openings in my Blitz game. It turns out I'm doing pretty decently with those new openings. Of course, I've got to keep them a secret from you guys. But I still have some other things to work on. Time management, slightly better, but lots and lots of room to improve. I also need to work on advantage capitalization and resourcefulness. On the other hand, my end games are doing well and my openings are doing well overall. So if you're looking for that kind of insight, as well as puzzles of tactics that you missed and chances to practice positions you didn't convert, then try out aimchess.com. If you do so, please use the code perpetual30 at aimchess.com. The link is also in the show description.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
And we are back. And Dean's new book is called Tricks, Tactics, and Tips in the Chess Opening. So, Dean, as we've alluded to, we've both got a lot going on. So with all of these activities, why write a chess book?
So this is one that I've kind of actively been working on for 8 years. And in a way, I've been kind of working on for 20 years, because it's most of my best lesson material that I've worked on and shown to hundreds, if not thousands of students. So I'm kind of obsessive compulsive about getting everything right. So I wanted to put all the material that I had, all the most instructive games that I thought got they're most instructional for the students, but also have something interesting about them that people will remember. Because people, if they have a good story that goes with it, they're much more likely to remember something. So I didn't just write it. So I basically, over the last 8 years, I was putting together all the best lesson plans and showing them to dozens of different groups, but dozens of different classes. And then every time a question that would come up that was interesting, or it would come up multiple times, I'd write it down and I'd put it in the book. So I wanted it to be something where like coaches could kind of almost use it as a blueprint to show to either their students or even their kids. And it's like a fundamental information for people that maybe even club players that are adults. I've had a few adults that have said that, well, I wish I knew this stuff, that are even like 1500, 1600 rated, and said, just going through this book, I see what's happening in my games. I'm just winning games from just the tricks and just the advice that are given here, because they just didn't have certain things taught to them when they were younger. So they're making the same mistakes over and over again. So it was kind of a process of like 8 active years of doing it. And then this in the last couple of years, especially during COVID, I had time to work on it more. And I just wanted to get all the details down, like where a coach could just go into a class and kind of show this, like step-by-step, the most common things that are going to happen in the opening, the most common things, the most common traps that people are going to fall into. And I try to have some kind of different stories and a lot of my own students' games that have happened during the writing of this book, that I can include that just have happened dozens of times. So everybody can kind of relate, and also they kind of see the same things happening multiple times and just realize, oh, okay, this is why it was happening, and now I know what to do against it. So there are some chapters I think are particularly important for certain levels, like of tournament players, like a fried liver attack and center fork trick, and like I have like a story in there from the Nationals from 1987 where I was playing the last round game against Talis Fekete, who wound up becoming the world junior champion. And it was my first Nationals, and I like didn't really know anything, but the last round I fell right into it. I lost really quickly. I had no idea what happened. And now, so I tell that story to students, like, if this happens, don't worry. This will happen to you multiple times before you start remembering it. And once they realize the things that are likely to happen and ways to avoid them, they're able to get like the kind of the easy things out of the way, so they're not just losing games quickly, and they're able to kind of get more out of their games later because they're playing full games and not just losing over and over again for the same reason.
Yeah, it's quite a good, like you say, it's great for scholastic players. Obviously, a great choice for coaches as well, because you've been in the trenches coaching for all these years, and as you say, this is some of your best material. And it reminds me a bit. I don't know if you're familiar, I'm guessing you are, with the art of attack in chess. To me, this is kind of like an entry-level version of it, which obviously is a classic book.
Yes. Thank you for comparing it to that. But thank you. I'm really happy with it because it basically takes a lot of my own games, a lot of my students' games, and a lot of classic games. So I try to get some kind of like a chess culture and chess history. And I think it's important for everybody to know like why certain things developed a certain way, how certain things were discovered, not just memorize certain games, not just memorize certain ideas, and just have some kind of historical background of how things happen. It just somehow it seems to help people remember things and also help them appreciate things and apply it more easily.
Yeah. And I do always, as you alluded to, I always enjoy when there are like non-professional games in, because it gives you sort of more grounded perspective, but also just like as someone who knows a lot of chess people, just to see random names pop up in a book is always fun.
Right. And I tell my students too, if they play an instructive game that uses something that we talk about, there's a good chance that it's going to be put in the book. So a lot of my students' games are in here. A lot of things I just notice come up very often. There's of course really classic games too, and games by great players, but there's a lot of games for my students and myself where like something that I notice, well, I'll see like a dozen times a week happen in a game. I'll just say, okay, go to this chapter, read this chapter, look at this game, and then you won't forget it again.
And in the modern landscape, Dean, obviously you work with adults, but you've been running scholastic programs for decades now. Are kids willing to read chess books if you tell them to, or are they more geared towards the more modern tools?
Yeah, at a certain level, yeah, they will want to use tools, and at some they want to use some of the modern tools, and they want to see videos. But I use this a lot the students will do it, especially at a certain age, and if they like to read. And I tried to keep a lot of the things in the book like fun and short, and like how I show things in my classes where the games themselves are not long. You're not having to read something. So if you have even a child that's like 6 or 7 years old, and they have an adult that can go through the game with them, and they know it's going to be like 10 minutes to show them the game. The kids will like it, and they'll like a lot of the tactics. So I try to keep it fun, because if it's not fun, then people will zone out. And I think if you do it in that kind of way, where it's kind of the way that things that I have been showing in class for more than 20 years, it'll keep everybody's attention. And if you have especially if you have a adult at home that plays chess, they'll be able to go through it with you, with a student, and they'll actually enjoy it and get something out of it too. But I stay away from any game that I couldn't show in a classroom setting in like 20, 25 minutes.
Okay.
So it's all supposed to be just like very, very quick, get to the point, remember the idea, remember the pattern. And if there's a fun story that goes along with it, then they're much more likely to remember the game as well.
Yeah. And we should say it's available in New in Chess Reader. I enjoy their ebook app, and of course you can get it in physical book, and I believe in Kindle. But Dean, so you're not sure yet if it's going to be on Chessable? Is that the status?
Yes. I'm hoping to find out this in the next couple of months if that's going to be turned into a Chessable course. Hopefully it will be, because it's basically the like. Exactly what I've been doing in the school programs for more than 20 years to think all the material that I taught myself and that I gave to teachers that were teaching for me, like for every really important topic that comes up in the opening. And originally I planned on this being like a all-encompassing book of the most common traps that happen at all stages of the game, but we kind of decided we're going to split it up into opening, middle game, and end game, because there's just too much material. So in a few months too, I'm hoping to start work on a middle game book with the most common themes like castling opposite sides, the Greek gift, all the most instructive and most historically important games too, for like all the themes that people can expect in the middle game. And again, the games being relatively short so that people of any level, any age can kind of enjoy it and get through it without feeling overwhelmed.
Sounds good. Just a couple more topics, Dean. I know this has been long, but you've got a lifetime of chess wisdom. And one topic you're unusually well-versed in is opening and running chess clubs, for better or for worse, yes. Scholastic academies.
Yes.
So you revealed your stock advice when someone asks you about it to me before we recorded, but could you repeat it for our audience? If someone says, yes. Hey, Dean, I'm thinking about opening a chess club, what do you tell them?
Yes, I've talked more people out of it than I have talked into it, because a lot of people, especially if they're masters, they think, okay, it's easy. You set up a chess club and then you have classes and it's great for everybody and you do this on the side. And it's like, if this isn't going to be something you're going to be able to devote full time to, you're going to have a lot of problems. So especially getting going, it's more than a full-time job to advertise, to get students, to handle kind of all the administrative work and red tape that goes along with it. And a lot of people have tried to do it kind of part-time and have lost a lot of money on it, lost a lot of time, and been really disappointed. It can be done, but you kind of have to do it for the right reasons, and it has to be like full-time. And I didn't even try to do it myself until I had about 40 schools that we were teaching in. And so I kind of had, if things went wrong, I still had 40 schools to rely on. And I started it very small, the first one, just to make sure that it worked well, and it did. And then the second one was bigger, and I went pretty much all the way through COVID. But then you see like things can happen that you don't anticipate, and like some pandemic can happen, and like what happened during COVID with basically not just me but almost everybody else that I know that had a chess academy. Basically, you were paying full rent in a store that you couldn't legally operate. So if you're going to do it, you have to set everything up the right way and know that it's a full-time job, especially for the first year, where you're going to have to, even if you have like a reputation out there and you know you're going to have certain students that are there, you're going to have to advertise, you're going to have to be there all the time, you're going to have to be following up, and And it's not going to be something where you can just open up and expect, okay, this is going to be some extra part-time job for me where I'm going to be able to make extra money. If that's the attitude, you're going to lose a lot of money. So it does take a huge amount of work. And like I said, I've talked more people out of it just because I don't want to see people going broke. Like having a physical location is always risky, and in certain areas it's riskier than others. So you have to make sure that you have everything lined up and are prepared to work really hard for at least the first year or two, just to get kind of your base established. And then it can work really well, and you can provide a lot of good education, a good atmosphere for students. But it takes a lot, and you can't just have some title or even like a reputation for being a good coach and expect it to work well unless you're going to put a lot of effort in up front.
Yeah, it's good advice. And to be clear, Dean, we're talking about opening a physical space, not like becoming an instructor and being in a lot of schools. I think it's relatively low barriers to entry, especially if you have a good reputation and you do good work. But once you're paying rent, it definitely raises the degree of difficulty significantly.
Yes, yes. And there are a lot of fun things I wanted to do. I wanted to see when I was a kid that I thought were missing. And I wanted to kind of incorporate that into a club. So it was like more because I loved it. I didn't expect that part to do as well as, let's say, the schools. And it did do well. But there's always things that can come up. And it took you had to really love teaching and love kind of almost like the business aspect of having a physical location. And if it's something that you're going to do like at nights after you have your other job, you're going to get yourself into a lot of debt. So it's great if people want to do it, but I've seen a lot of places close because you have to be good at a lot of different things and you have to put a lot of time in upfront.
Yep. All the more respect to our friends down there in Charlotte that they're making it happen. Yes. And for listeners who want to hear more on the subject, I would direct them to my first interview, not the adult improver interview, but my first interview with FM Peter Giannatos, and also my interview from way back in the archives with Adam Weisbarth of Silver Knights. So if you are interested in starting a chess club, I would definitely heed Dean's warnings and tread carefully. And really, just like Dean going for the GM title, you've got to really be committed if you're going to do it. But you can check out those interviews. And so, Dean, I understand that apropos of this conversation, you're doing primarily online stuff now.
Yes. I'm doing some private and in-class things too, in-school things too. But I primarily, since COVID, that's when everything kind of switched to online, and it's still gone very well at a very loyal base of students that most of them have kind of stuck with me 3 years online. But I am going to be doing some things in person too. I do private lessons and some, I'm going to be doing some school programs as well. But primarily right now, yes, like it's a lot is still online.
Okay. And if anyone listening is interested looking for a teacher, do you have any availability or any like online classes for adults potentially coming?
It's mostly, most of the classes are still the online classes are for Scholastic players. Unfortunately, you know, when you're an adult, I've tried for years to get adult classes going, and people are excited at first. And even when there's physical adult classes, you could start out with a big group of adults and then something comes up, somebody gets sick in the family, and it deteriorates pretty quickly. So like adults will do things for their kids that they won't necessarily do for themselves. So, you know, it's like you'll be willing to go out of your way for your kids, but for yourself, it's much harder. So I don't do too many adult lessons or adult classes, but in the right situation, if there was a lot of people that they're interested, then I would consider it, but primarily the Scholastic students are the ones that I work with.
Okay. So if any chess parents are listening, We'll link to your info. Now, Dean, last topic, I think. I was creeping through your chess-based game history, looking at some of the titans you've played. You played Hikaru in Foxwoods in 2009. You played Yusupov. You played Sarawan in a U.S. championship. So I'm curious, and obviously you've got all these titles as well, all these national championships and such. What are your sort of most treasured memories from all these years battling?
I think there are some games that themselves were kind of like my best memories of some games where they were, were just fun and you beat someone who's really famous. A lot of it is like the fun parts outside of actually playing. When we were younger and always to do fun things in between the games. But in terms of like specific games, like some of the most memorable ones, like the probably my favorite one was for the first round of the Rilton Cup in 2017 against Sasakiran, who kind of had beaten me in a tournament in England in 1998 when we were like relatively similar in strength. We were both like young IMs, like almost the same rating. And then within a couple of years, he was playing Kasparov and I was like teaching. And in 2017, when I was like dropped all the way to like the lowest point where it was like 23-30 FIDE. And the first round, I was playing him and he was he had won the tournament the previous year and he was the top seed and like almost 2,700 feet in. And he was obviously like jet lagged. So it's not going to be in his best game collections and he would obviously beat me now, but just, I felt I was jet lagged, but I was really relaxed. And for some reason, like I had a good feeling from the start of the game and just played quickly and comfortably and it was probably one of the most accurate games I played. And it was like being commented on by Alf Anderson, who,
oh wow,
like the great, and he was saying like some of the nicest things I ever heard. So I said, all right, if someone like that can say good things about how you're playing, then it's a good sign that I don't have to quit. So that tournament started out well, and then each round got worse and worse. But the first game is like a good impression that you can still, if you can still play a game like that, you know that there's still like there's still a chance to improve. And then I kind of started being a little more serious again after that, because I realized I still had it in me to play with some top players, but there are obviously like a lot of games that make like a big impression where you feel like you turned a corner. And like the other one that I'll mention that was like one of my favorite games was from you might have been, I don't remember if you were at that tournament. I know like a lot of our group was at the tournament, like the 1997 New York Open. In the first round, I played against Morozevich and
wow,
and won. And like, he was like, yeah, that was like within, yeah, I don't know,
that was
a
like
year Pete, before. Yeah. Yes. Pete, yeah. That was fun. Yeah. He was like, within a year, he'd be number three in the world. And again, like if he played me as if he was playing like Shirov or someone like that, then he would have just been more accurate at a certain point. But because it was the first round, he was playing someone who was like 300 something points higher rated. You get a little in the first round, so you can, we've been on both sides of this where you're the higher player or you're the lower player. And you know, accidents can happen when you're playing someone who's better than their rating. And when you're not totally taking them seriously, or your brain isn't totally in the tournament yet. So I'm sure after that, he like won a bunch of games in a row. In the last round, he was playing for first place. But in the first round, that game was like the start of the first I Am Norm that I got. And then, I started to get better very quickly right after that. But you can see like there's certain games and kind of everyone's career where it's like, that's like the starting point where I started to get serious. And like, then you knew you were going to gain a couple hundred points within a few years. But like in terms of from Master and beyond, those are like two games that kind of stand out.
Rightfully so. That's impressive stuff. And the Rilton Cups in Stockholm, I believe, what about in terms of chess travels, Dean? I mean, what have been your favorite places that you've gotten to play?
Oh, the Gibraltar was great. I haven't gotten there in, I've only been there once, but that was a really fun tournament. There's the Rilton Cup is great. That's like one of the ones that also makes kind of you feel like you can have like a little bit of a social atmosphere and then still play a serious game the next day. One of the most interesting places was like the World Junior was in India in 1998, and Irina Krush was the U.S. representative, and she did really well that year. She got third, and I was the U.S. representative for the boys' side. I didn't do that well, but it turns out about half the players that I played that year, like within a year, wound up being really strong grandmasters. So again, you never know, like if you're playing people who are going to be really good. So don't be disappointed in that result. But the experience itself in India there was great. So there's a lot of places like they still miss like the tournaments that they used to have in Groningen and. In the Hollands in like late 90s, those were,
Greg had some stories. Greg Shahadi had some stories from there.
Yes, that was fun. Yeah, we were at one of those in like the 1997, but all those tournaments were a lot of fun because it's one game a day and there's like a nice relaxed atmosphere and all the players get along and you do things after the tournament and you relax and have fun. And so like these kinds of events where you actually it's kind of more of I wouldn't say like a hobby, but I'd say like you can relax a little more instead of like the intense American tournaments where you're playing two games a day and they're like brutal on you. They take a toll. That's why like almost any grandmaster from like Europe, when they come and move to the United States for a year, they like lose 50 points like instantly because it's just hard. If you're not used to it. So it's fun here. Like what they have in Charlotte with two rounds a day, but there's also something we said, I do like the tournaments, like the cultural atmosphere in a lot of the, like the European tournaments where you get to do some other things and see like see the city and then you're playing for 4 hours, but you get to do other things and just kind of unwind.
Yeah. It's more civilized for sure.
yes. Yeah.
And all right, Dean, going to put you on the spot for one more question.
Sure.
Who is the most impressive player you've ever analyzed with?
Oh, wow. I'm sure, there's some players that just like, they seem to see everything. And there are like a lot of players that now I'm sure if I analyze with them, they're like, I wouldn't be able to keep up with them. But like there are some like top players, like someone like Shanklin just sees everything instantly. So yeah. I analyzed with him, like even when he was like, we played at the US Championship in 2008 and I beat him. I'm at arm wrestling before the game, but he beat me really during the game. But he was like 22 something player, and it's like I thought like okay, I lost two games in a row, so I should be able to beat him. And he just crushed me. And like a couple of years later, he's like a strong grandmaster. So he's just like calculating like things so quickly. There's some people that that you just notice. Like even I analyzed with I wonder Liang this past weekend when I played him in Charlotte, and he just, you know, calculates everything quickly.
You drew him though, right?
Yes. Yeah. But it was a good game, but he just like also, he's not playing all the time and still he's able to calculate it. And he's also really nice. So
I loved his interviews at the US Championship where he played some dodgy opening and he was just like, yeah, yes. I'm in college now. I don't care anymore.
He played against Aronian and he just beat him with this gambit. And he's just like really nice and well-adjusted. And he's like happy to analyze the game. So, but there's all these players that I think you can kind of tell based on like a couple minutes of analysis. And even like, obviously I played Nakamura a ton of times when he was, especially when he was younger, and like when he would like mention variations after the game, or if he would see a game and he would just be he would just mention to you after, like, oh yeah, what happens if this and that? And I would mention something like, and he would just think, oh yeah. And the only reason I know that is because I looked at it with the computer and he's like figuring this out.
Right.
I didn't actually figure this line out. I just put the game on the computer afterwards and he would ask about something and see it instantly. So there's like a lot of these, even like Caruana, I played at the US Open when he was like 13. And I remember telling him, so I beat him then, but he was like maybe 2,400, but it was like just the things that he was seeing and the things that he already knew. I think I told him when we were analyzing, like, oh, you're just going to be one of the top players in the world in 10 years. It was like literally 10 years to the month that he had that tournament at Singfield Cup where he won 7 games in a row.
Yeah.
And it was crazy what he was seeing when he was 13, and had to work really hard, and just, he already knew more than me.
Right.
So we analyzed probably for 40 minutes and you could just tell that, okay, this is going to be one of the top players in the world.
Yeah. I mean, and so getting back to our earlier conversation, there is a beauty in that, you know, the passing of the torch, like now you have this memory from playing with a modern legend where if you'd quit, you know, you would have never gotten that experience.
Right. Yeah. It's still nice. I want to still be able to play these open tournaments in the US because one of these, I'm sure, Caruana came close, but one of these players, at some point you'll get a chance to beat them when they're young enough, and then they'll want to becoming a world champion. So
yeah, for sure.
They beat the world champion. So
yeah. All right. Well, Dean, this has been amazing. Anything else you wanted to, hit that I haven't asked you about?
No, I think we covered pretty much, we covered pretty much everything. And one thing I did want to mention to keep everything on a positive note, it's why like just keep playing and don't give up. Like someone great, like Nagy, who was one of the top grandmasters.
Yeah, he was there
ever.
In Charlotte.
Yeah, he was at the tournament, but like he hasn't played in a while. So he also, I was really impressed with him. He was really nice. I played him in 2008 when I was starting to get close to making the GM norms, and we played in a tournament. He was already a strong grandmaster and had already been one of the youngest grandmasters in the world. And he was nice enough to go over the game with me. He just knew everything.
Yeah.
So then when he played here, it's obviously like one of the most talented players and it's like one of the top grandmasters ever. And then he plays here and like he starts out well and then like starts drawing because everybody is good. It's hard to play even for someone who, if he wanted to, could be one of the top players in the world. He doesn't play chess regularly now. It's hard to not be kind of flat unless you're playing all the time. It's hard to have a good tournament unless you're playing all the time. So even for him, like it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who you are. If you're not playing all the time and not doing some tactics training and really making an effort to improve, the game is difficult now. So everybody's kind of working harder. So if you're prepared to work hard, you can still do it. But if you're not, then it's going to be difficult for anybody. And also it's kind of hard cope. If you play somebody who's really good and you know they haven't played for a while, you can kind of outwork them and outthink them because they're just out of practice.
Yep. Yeah. Again, throwing it back to what we were discussing earlier. And just for any listeners not familiar, who we're discussing is Grandmaster Parmesan Nagy. He was one of the top prodigies in the world and then went to Stanford. He also wrote a couple great opening books for Quality Chess. But yeah, it was a pleasant surprise when I saw his name in the cross table.
Yes, yeah. And see, he's like a hard worker. The opening books are great. But then if you're not actually doing something all the time, it's hard to compete no matter how much you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's a good note to end on. Yeah, and I echo what you were saying about not meaning to be discouraging. I mean, like I was getting at what I was saying earlier, where like sometimes in life I can procrastinate and lack discipline, and now when I compete, I feel I have to be disciplined, and I think that's a good thing for me. Like the fact that I'm I can get distracted by my phone. And when I compete in a tournament, I'm not distracted by my phone. Like, just these little things like that to me, whether one achieves their goals or not, there's something grounding to me about this form of competition, even if it's more challenging than it used to be. Do you feel the same way, Dean?
Yes, exactly. And I don't care, like, if you're what age you are, if you're all in and you want to make a plan to do it, you can do it. You just have to, and you definitely can do it, but you just have to realize it's going to be difficult. And there's going to be times when you get discouraged and when you feel like you were close to something and then it's so far away, but it doesn't mean you have to quit. And just the main thing is to kind of concentrate on the process and just you have to be smart about everything and work really hard away from the board and work really hard at the board. And if you do that and you kind of stick to it and set yourself a goal, and no matter what, you just continue to do it. I mean, for me now, it's like 18 years since I made this notebook. And if somebody told me, I would have 100 pieces of paper on it that tell me a checklist of week by week that I'd still have it. I would have said, no, you're nuts. Like, this is going to happen in 2 or 3 years. So you pick something, no matter what happens, you have some setbacks, some things you can control, some things you can't, but you stick with it. At some point it will happen.
Okay. Well, Dean, like I said, we'll be rooting for you. And I love the attitude. It'll be wish you luck in your upcoming tournaments and with everything else.
Thank you so much. And thank you for having me, Ben.
Oh, sure, Dean. And if people want to reach you, your email address is on your website, right? I mean,
it's also easy to remember. It's just dean@deanofchess.com.
Okay, perfect. All right. Well, Dean, hopefully we cross paths IRL at one of these tournaments. But in the meantime, happy holidays and good luck with everything.
Thank you. You too. And I hope to see you in person soon too.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, Beneficial1 on Twitter, @PerpetualChess on Instagram, or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on the next...
Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.